Chapter 8, Stirring the Pot After Glenister II. A conception of democracy which is committed to a notion of freedom and dignity, self-rule and self-respect, must entail a commitment to a form of political practice that guarantees to each person the basic social conditions required for the fulfillment of these commitments. So said Judge Dennis Davis. Lots of noses were put out of joint by the finding of the majority of the Constitutional Court judges in what has become known as Glenister II. Besides the government and the ANC, whose noses were properly bloodied, they included the proboscis of those who had confidently predicted that the case could not be won and had therefore declined to have anything to do with it, either as a friend of the court or as co-applicant. Over at Luthuli House, the ANC's headquarters in Johannesburg, Secretary General Gwede Montashe muttered darkly about counter-revolutionary judges, as if any judges sworn to uphold the constitutions of their countries could normally be described as revolutionaries. Academic commentators pored over the judgment and marveled at the scope of its finding that the democratically elected parliament would have to return to the drawing board to create an independent institution of state capable of preventing and combating corruption. The judges had been careful to avoid telling Parliament what to do. Instead, they described the internationally accepted attributes of a successful anti-corruption entity and specialized body of well-trained personnel who would enjoy security of tenure, access to adequate and guaranteed resources and funding, and the room to operate independently, free of executive interference or influence. These precepts were the criteria against which a constitutionally sound entity would be measured in the future. Clearly, the Hawks did not meet these criteria. The security of its members was questionable. Their vulnerability to executive interference and influence was built into the founding legislation. They were also not specialists in combating corruption. Instead, their mandate was extended to cover priority crimes, which in terms of the legislation would be defined and selected by the executive and not the Hawks themselves. Small wonder, then, that the Constitutional Court judges gave Parliament a period of 18 months to think about and implement its ruling. The victorious parties, Bob Glenister and the Helen Suzman Foundation, both decided to follow through on the unexpected victory. This seemed to be the most responsible way of utilising the surprise win they had achieved through perseverance and hard work. The Helen Suzman Foundation organized a workshop to discuss the way forward, which was attended by academics, government officials, and representatives of relevant NGOs. Puzzlingly, neither Bob nor his legal team was invited. Accountability Now was also not on the guest list. The workshop was held in private, and the outcome, if any, was not made public. The Helen Suzman Foundation did, at a later stage, confer with the Glenister team about the line to take during the renewed public participation process in Parliament. After a few conference calls facilitated by the attorneys acting for the Helen Suzman Foundation, they agreed to differ. Bob and his team wanted to go for broke and campaign for a new Chapter 9 institution, an integrity commission. In his view, such an entity would slot in neatly between the public protector, who is mandated to deal with public maladministration, and the auditor general, who checks government accounts for irregular and wasteful expenditure. A commission with a mandate to prevent and combat corruption in the public and private sectors would fill the gaps left by the public sector-oriented focus of the auditor general and public protector, neither of whom had a mandate to deal with corruption in the private sector. Team Helen Suzman Foundation was not as ambitious as Team Glenister. Like the DA, it favoured the reintroduction of a Scorpions-like entity. The difficulty with this proposal was that, like the Scorpions, such an entity would not enjoy the same security of tenure as Chapter 9 institutions, so named after their enabling chapter in the Constitution, established to help bed down South Africa's constitutional democracy. No person may interfere with the functioning of these institutions, and other organs of state are required to assist and protect them in order to ensure their independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness. The institutions themselves are enjoined to act impartially without fear, favour, or prejudice. By contrast, the Scorpions could be disbanded because they were creatures of statute and could be destroyed by the same parliament that had created them. Amending the constitution to create a new Chapter 9 institution would be much more difficult to reverse than ordinary legislation. Bob decided that the idea of a new Chapter 9 institution needed to be tested in the national marketplace and put up the funding for what became known as the Glenister Challenge. Participants in three categories, universities, civil society, and an open category, were invited to submit their ideas for remedial legislation and a memorandum justifying their choices. Three retired judges, Johan Krichler of the Constitutional Court, Ian Farlam of the Supreme Court of Appeal, and Wilfred Thring of the Western Cape High Court, agreed to adjudicate the entries. A team of communications consultants led by Danny Cohen and Sandra Saure of Prologue Consulting were engaged to get the message into the public domain and attract as many participants as possible. Law, public administration, and politics departments at universities were asked to interest their students in the project. People active in the private sector could enter in the open section. A few entrants who tried the one-liner, bring back the death penalty, were promptly eliminated, but the overwhelming majority of all categories made a serious effort to formulate a new law and explain and justify their choices. The competition kept the options in the public eye, and accountability now did what it could to reinforce the promotion of an integrity commission. This strategy involved writing opinion pieces for newspapers, appearing on radio and television, and talking to audiences as diverse as clubs, universities, and religious organizations. In the event, the government gave the task of preparing the remedial legislation to the police, which seemed likely to result in a proposal for a Super Hawks unit in the place of the Hawks. The failure to involve the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development in this process seemed to scupper any hopes of creating a new Chapter 9 institution to embody the STIRS, meaning specialized, trained, independent, resourced, and secure criteria spelled out by the Constitutional Court. A unit within the police would fail to meet several of these criteria, notably independence and security of tenure. When the new draft bill was published, it was met with dismay. It seemed aimed at doing as little as possible to meet the requirements of the judgment. Many analysts and role players felt this was not enough, and so did the participants in the renewed public participation process. A single participant, a professor at the University of the Witwatersrand, supported the structural and operational changes contained in the bill. All of the other 20-odd submissions to the Police Portfolio Committee in the National Assembly criticized the bill and made constructive suggestions for improving it. The universities category in the Glenister Challenge was won by a two-person team from the University of Stellenbosch, pipping a Rhodes University team at the post. In the civil society section, a team of Ndifuna Ukwazi, Dare to Know, part of the Social Justice Coalition stable, prevailed over its competitors. The challenge was rounded off with a prize-giving party at the Vineyard Hotel in Cape Town, which was enjoyed by all. More soberly, the entries had no impact whatsoever on the government drafting team. It was taking its instructions from the Tooley House. Counter-revolutionary judges were not to be heeded in anything but the most minimal way. The notion of a majority party in a constitutional democracy being constrained by the separation of powers is greatly misunderstood in the corridors of the Tooley House. There is even less appreciation of the fact that laws and conduct that are inconsistent with the Constitution are invalid. The Tooley House firmly believes that a majority party can do what it likes, and the minority, as well as the courts, must bow before its will. President Zuma himself let this slip in an exchange in Parliament with the DA's then parliamentary leader, Lindiwe Mazibuko. "The majority has more rights than the minority," he declared. "That is how democracy works." But constitutional democracy does not work in that way at all. The Constitution means what the Constitutional Court says it means. The courts are independent of political parties and subject only to the law and the Constitution, which they must apply without fear, favour, or prejudice. An order or decision issued by a court binds all relevant parties, including organs of state. These notions are clearly and concisely set out in Section 165 of the Constitution, which says that the state has a duty to assist and protect the courts, to ensure the independence, impartiality, dignity, accessibility, and effectiveness of the courts. All of this means that the remedial action ordered by the Constitutional Court had to be consistent with the Constitution. The new Hawke's legislation failed to measure up to these standards by a country mile. The political will to deal effectively and decisively with corruption remained conspicuously absent. Bob briefed Accountability Now and his new Cape Town-based attorney, Marjorie du Plessis, of the firm Cooper and Associates, to make representations to the Portfolio Committee. So did the Helen Suzman Foundation and many other leading civil society organizations. Everyone, bar one lonely Wits University professor, warned of the unconstitutionality of the new bill. And Bob asked the committee to send it back to the drawing board. We argued on his behalf that it was impossible to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and that the bill was the latter. The ANC members of the committee had their instructions. Asking them to accept that the bill was fundamentally flawed was like asking them to grow wings and fly. Their very jobs depended upon their supporting it. They did, however, take some civil society criticism seriously and introduced about 50 minor amendments. Unfortunately, the amendments tended to compound the confused thinking already embodied in the bill. Warnings that the amended bill still did not pass constitutional muster fell on deaf ears. Clearly, the government was determined to do as little as possible to comply with the STIRS criteria spelled out by the Constitutional Court. Attempts to involve Chapter 9 institutions, particularly the Human Rights Commission and the Public Protector, in the debate did not succeed. Eventually, the bill passed through both Houses of Parliament, propelled by the ANC majority. All we could do now, short of litigating, was to ask the President not to sign the bill into law, as it did not comply with the Constitution, a power conferred on him by the Constitution itself. He could either send the bill back to Parliament or refer it to the Constitutional Court for its imprimatur on the constitutionality of its provisions. Instead, he signed the bill into law just within the 18-month deadline. The new law made minor changes to the powers of the Hawks and some cosmetic changes to its structure and functioning. Working separately and without consulting one another, Team Glenister and Team Helen Suzman Foundation considered the new situation and decided to approach the Constitutional Court directly on the grounds that the new legislation did not meet its criteria and should therefore be declared unconstitutional. Team Helen Suzman Foundation adopted a lean and mean approach based on the text of the new provisions. Team Glenister, while also critical of the text, adopted a broader approach, arguing that in the circumstances prevailing in the executive, the police and the Hawks themselves, the whole scheme of the new act was unconstitutional. The phrase, in the circumstances, was drawn from the majority judgment in Glenister 2, which stated, "Now plainly, there are many ways in which the state can fulfill its duty to take positive measures to respect, protect, promote and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights. This court will not be prescriptive as to what measures the state takes, as long as they fall within the range of possible conduct that a reasonable decision maker in the circumstances may adopt. A range of possible measures is therefore open to the state, all of which will accord with the duty the Constitution imposes, so long as the measures taken are reasonable." Team Glenister set out to argue that the new measures were unreasonable given the state of the executive populated with feral politicians and led by a person facing the reinstatement of 783 corruption charges, a dysfunctional police force which was mismanaged and poorly led by political appointees, and the parlous position of the Hawks itself, a dysfunctional and mismanaged police unit led by political appointees under the ANC's notorious and unconstitutional cadre deployment policy. In the event, the Constitutional Court took one look at the two applications and rejected them summarily without giving either party a hearing. It was not prepared to address the issues before a lower court had done so. So, teams Helen Suzman Foundation and Glenister rejigged their papers for an approach to the Western Cape High Court, asking it to declare the Superhawk legislation invalid. Team Helen Suzman Foundation persisted in its narrow and technical approach, while Team Glenister continued to focus on the unsuitability of locating an anti-corruption entity within the police, besides its technical attacks on the structure of the legislation and how the new Hawks would be required to function. Another major battle in the war against corruption was about to begin.